Keith, you lived in England.
I did, yeah.
You know who else did?
No.
Harry Potter.
Ooh, do tell.
Harry Potter is now available on Audible. And guess what, Keith?
What?
If you don't have to go back to England to get a copy of the audiobook.
Thank God.
You can just go to audibletrial.com/Midwestern, and you can download, of the 7 Harry Potter books, you can download one of them for free.
Fantastic.
It's on us. It's on the Midwestern Social Scientists. We're buying tonight.
Who would turn that down?
I wouldn't. That's audibletrial.com/Midwestern. Welcome, everybody, to episode 38 of the Midwestern Social Scientists. I'm Dr. Kip Pietrantonio, and with me always...
Keith McIntosh.
All right, Keith. It's a tough topic today.
Yeah, we're kind of taking a serious topic this time.
Yeah, this isn't like Kurt Cobain, or I guess he was a serious topic too, but I mean, there's less fun to be had, I think, with this one.
No, in his own way, Kurt Cobain is a serious topic, but no, this is a sort of a big political topic of the day.
Yeah, so we were like, we got to talk about this, and you probably can guess what it is. We're going to be talking about terrorism.
Yeah, and specifically the events in Paris, what was it, 10 days ago or so?
Yeah, when this is recording, it was about 10 days ago, so in the future, this will be Kip and Keith's kind of pretty near reactions.
Yeah, time capsule reaction to the events.
You know how, like, in the Congress, they're always like, I voted against the war in Iraq. Like, this is, like, our moment right now.
Yeah, I'm sure that many people will be listening, too.
Like, they're going to be like, what did Kip and Keith say 10 years ago? Like, did they predict what was going
to
happen?
When future historians are writing our biographies, this is what they'll turn to.
They're going
to
be like, Keith, he was going through a tough phase in his life. Just started his PhD program. His political views were... skewed.
Malleable and changing.
He was going taking a globalization class.
Overly leftist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're actually face-to-face as well. If you're a consistent listener, you might know that I left the great city of Columbus, Ohio, and moved to the great city of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm home, on break, and we're face-to-face. So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And so this...
Feels good.
It does feel good. But I was thinking this podcast would be... So it's not about us dispensing our infinite wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we have any infinite wisdom. And
I have a little bit. I keep it in a drawer.
I have finite wisdom.
Yeah.
Little dollops of wisdom, but that's it. Your wisdom shines like a rainbow.
Yeah, that's true.
I've noticed that.
I have. I sometimes see that in a glimmer in my eye.
So I'm not here to give my expertise on these matters because I don't have expertise on these matters. My interests are in sociology. Kip's interests are in psychology. But we are two citizens who are interested in the world, who I think are very open-minded and empathetic and willing to look at the world from the point of view of the other, and interested in diagnosing this problem in the most accurate way possible.
Right.
So we're here just to have a conversation, ideally two brains that are wide open, willing to talk about this topic, that it's really contentious, really emotional, and just sort of walk through it and offer up observations. And maybe listeners will hear themselves and some of our opinions. And maybe we'll offer up something that you haven't thought about before.
Yeah.
So that's the goal for today.
Yeah, for sure. So, okay. So, Keith, I guess maybe the kind of the logical place to start would be kind of initial reactions to hearing about the Paris attacks and kind of what was going on for you when you first... when you first heard about them, and you're sitting in Philadelphia, you're just sitting in class or something, and all of a sudden, you know, you wake up in the morning or whatever happened.
Yeah, no, it was a big deal. I mean, I'm 29. I was born in 86. So in high school, 9/11 happened when I was 15, maybe about to turn 16.
Yeah.
I was going through driver's training, and that's why that's my marker in time. And as horrible as that was, I think I was young enough that it didn't hit me in the way it would have had I been an adult. So I was aware it was a big deal. I was horrified in a sense, but it was enough like a Hollywood movie, and it was enough of just a breakdown in the order of the day. You know, kids went home from school and stuff, that there was a kind of thrill, and not in a negative way or to be, cold. There was a kind of thrill to it. And I was shocked to experience the Paris attacks in such an emotional way.
Hmm.
It really hit me in a way that I wouldn't have thought. If you had asked me if this happened theoretically, how would you feel? Uh-huh. I probably would have said, well, you know what, it's sad, but I've experienced so much of these events in my life that it's just like something on TV that's uh-huh. like, you know, not real. But it didn't feel that way at all. I mean, yeah. I was like near tears watching it.
Wow.
And I don't know why necessarily. I mean, I think really highly of France. I've been there briefly, but it's not that I have any real personal connection. Mm-hmm. But just as like a fan of history, I think France is a very important country, and mm-hmm. I think highly of the French people and so on and so forth. And I guess America has a certain connection with the Statue of Liberty as a gift from France and stuff. And mm-hmm. There was something, I think, something about such a horrible event where even though 9/11 was worse and more spectacular, there's something, I guess in a way, something even worse about an individual just walking into a building with a machine gun mm-hmm. and just like annihilating people. Like in a yeah. sense, that's more inhumane. And
I think part of that is that like you probably had never thought of somebody using a plane like that
yeah.
as an attack before it happened. Like that had never been something that entered my consciousness. Like somebody could take over a plane and then crash it into a building.
Every time a plane had been hijacked before, it was for ransom.
Right.
And usually those planes landed.
So versus I think we've all kind of been exposed to the visual of like, you know, a guy with a machine gun. I think about like Home Alone.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to fill you full of lead. You know what I mean? And it's just yeah. like that that visual of somebody just like emptying a Tommy gun or something like that.
I do kind of think of school shootings though.
Right. That's a good point. But I'm just saying in terms of visually seeing it, it's something I think we can picture happening a little bit more. Yeah. But like being in a plane that crashes and like that's a little more abstract, I guess.
Totally.
It's hard to put yourself in the shoes versus you can picture yourself in a bank like looking at somebody and somebody walks in and you see what you see in a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
So how did you feel when it happened?
Well, you know, to me, I think I had a different response than you did. I don't think I felt nearly as emotional about it. Not because I'm like a jerk or anything like that. I think it's just like a time of year where I'm very busy at work, which, you know, is not an excuse and is totally a component of privilege to be like, I've got work to do, you know?
Yeah.
But I think for me, when I first heard about it, I was kind of like, yeah, this happens like all the time. You know, Keith and I, as we were kind of doing our research, looking, you know, you look at the calendar of terrorist attacks that occur around the world. There's a beautiful Wikipedia page, and there's literally one every day.
Yeah.
Like, it's astonishing to see.
Frightening.
Yeah, that you only hear like about these couple of famous ones that happen every year, but literally, it's every day of the calendar year. There's a terrorist attack that occurs somewhere in the world, majority of them occurring in the Middle East. And so to me, I think at first I was kind of like, oh, okay, like, that happened.
Just another one.
Yeah, just another one. But then it was like, then it, like, started really dominating the news. And then on, like, social media, everybody was changing their Facebook, like, their photos to, to like, Paris flags and things like that. So then I started, like, okay, I gotta look into this a little deeper. Like, what happened? And that's when I started reading a little bit more. But I think that I was talking about this with somebody at work the other day. I think it's really sad that if I had just heard this on NPR, I would have never thought about it again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If they were like, oh, there was bombings and machine gun fire in Paris today.
Next story. Under the next story.
In other news, England has readjusted the pound.
I could totally see that.
And I would have been like, oh, that happened. Yeah. You know? And it's just like there was something different about this one where there was more of a reaction from everybody.
Yeah.
And I guess I was just surprised about that. So I didn't know what to make of that. I still don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think any of that's shocking at all. I mean, I'm in the same boat. I think the fact that there were multiple attacks that occurred concurrently mm-hmm. implies a level of sophistication and a lot of work going into it. So mm-hmm. you immediately know it's not a haphazard event. It's not some, you know, kooky guy who you know, went off his rocker or whatever and shot someone. It seems like an act of war in that sense. It's organized.
Right.
That was something that stuck with me when I found out that. And then the other thing, and I'd be interested to hear your reaction on this. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple of suicide martyrs or whatever, suicide bombers.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird that I want to call them martyrs just because I hear that language outside of the football stadium. And I thought they were inside of the stadium at first. And mm-hmm. the first time I saw the video, when I heard the explosions, I was waiting for people in the stands to get blown up based mm-hmm. off of what I had heard. But in any event, so I think maybe two, maybe more killed themselves outside of the stadium, and people in the stadium heard the bombs go off but didn't realize what it was.
Mm.
And then by the end, word had spread what was going on. So there's a shot of everyone in the stadium out on the field, And it's kind of chaotic, but it's mostly just sad. You know, people are afraid. So you see the shot of the green grass, this big stadium, and then it's just full of people in this moment of, like, you know, fright. And it reminded me of a scene in the third Batman movie.
Yeah.
Where the ground
Dark Knight Rises. Yeah.
And I couldn't help but think there is, like, I mean, why would the writer of that movie pick a situation like that? It's because there is a cinematic quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big public gathering, right? And it's intended to inspire terror. And then here it is happening in real life. And just visually, my brain made that link.
Right.
Doesn't mean there's anything to it, but I think it's kind of interesting that when 9/11 happened, people kept thinking this was a movie. They didn't realize the first time they saw the image of the towers going down that it was reality. And again, I made a certain link to like Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that was just kind of weird to me, something that sticks with me.
Is you ever seen Black Hawk Down?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Is that the movie where a bomb goes off in like the stadium?
I don't know. I remember that part.
Maybe I can't remember what it is. But it's mostly, maybe it's not Black Hawk Down, but there's some movie where they like basically let off a nuke like in the middle of the Super Bowl or something like that. And it's like
the ultimate act of terrorism.
Yeah, I can't remember what the movie's called. That's going to drive me nuts.
Maybe somebody can email if they want to. And then finding out that there was this concert hall and a band that like is in my, it's not a band I listen to, Eagles of Death Metal. Do you know what the...
Yeah, sorry, I just found the movie. The movie's called The Sum of All Fears.
Okay.
That's what the movie... It makes sense. That's an appropriate title.
Is that Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman? I remember that now. So, and then finding
Harrison
out that... Harrison Ford.
No, maybe not. Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman, yep.
So then finding out that there was this just incredible attack at this concert hall with the Eagles of Death Metal playing.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Queens of the Stone Age. There's a guy that's in both bands, Josh Holm, I think is his name. And that the body count was not like a dozen or two dozen.
Yeah.
But was up around 100 people.
Jesus.
And
that's so scary.
I know. And I saw a picture.
Like you wouldn't even think about being, you've been at a concert.
Yeah.
Like if you're ever, like your brain wouldn't even begin to think about that. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God.
Yeah, and I think that was the reaction from people inside of the concert hall. They thought there was some kind of almost like firework display. It's Kip's dog in the background.
Nochi.
Nochi responding.
Yeah, Nochi's upset. So.
And they thought it was some kind of firework display or somehow a part of the show. And of course, then they started to see people fall and realize what was happening. And I'm sure there was just that moment of like, this can't be real.
Right.
Everything moving in slow motion and so on and so forth. The absolute slaughter in a situation like that is so overwhelming and so like spectacular in a horrible way that I think this event more so than other maybe similar events like the bombs in London or the bombing in Spain, this was quite a few years ago now, this event I think stood out in comparison to all of those, and especially coming after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. I think there's just this feeling, I have to assume, inside of...
Why don't you give a background on that, Charlie Hebdo?
Yeah, Charlie Hebdo is a satirical cartoon in Paris that I had never heard of before the attack. But I guess they're very notorious. They've been around for decades. And to be honest, at least to American eyes, they seem sort of racist. They're very provocative.
Right.
But they're basically leftists. They're like people who are very critical, who make fun of everything.
Right. Like kind of like Matt Parker and Trace, or Trey Parker and Matt Stone, South Park guys.
Yeah, I guess maybe South Park would be the closest American analog to it. Mm-hmm. But some of the drawings have this kind of feel. You know what it reminds me of? Cartoons from the 1920s that are like, racist and shocking to us now.
Where like they exaggerate people's features and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. They have that kind of look. But my understanding is these cartoons are sort of beloved in the sense that they're a part of French culture. And it's just sort of understood that everyone does get made fun of. Everyone is subjected to this sort of criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, these guys drew really inflammatory images of Muhammad. I suppose any image of Muhammad is inflammatory because you're not supposed to do that. And sort of flaunted these sort of insults. And a couple of guys stormed the headquarters. Mm-hmm. You know, just a few dozen people are working there and slaughtered quite a few. Mm-hmm. 20-ish people died. And that was just this horrific event, and that took place in January of last year, so not even a year ago.
Wow.
And that was something that inspired all of European leaders to go to Paris and march alongside François Hollande. Obama didn't go. That was a little bit controversial.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, I think that was seen as a watershed event, And then the fact that this came after that so shortly, mm-hmm. I think there's just this feeling in the air now, especially in the context of the refugee crisis in Syria, that the world is like at a kind of a boiling point.
Right.
There's just this feeling in the air of unease. And it may very well pass without, you know, an incident, but it feels tense right now.
Who do you, Keith, if the boiling point is like between two parties, what would you say the two parties are here?
What do you mean?
Like, I think about a boiling point is like there's tension between two sides, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't see it as like in the context of America so much. I mean, American politicians are, I guess, appropriating the scandal for their own gains.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as tension between, it really is like, it is like Western civilization. It sounds so dramatic, but it's about freedom of speech, freedom of the press. The idea that we're all equal, and that, like Charlie Hebdo, like I was just saying, they sort of exemplify those values, which might sound a little blasphemous in the sense that it's like this sort of quasi-racist, weird, like provocative magazine. But the ability to not, to say whatever you want in public without fear and without the threat of violence coming back against you, that's a really positive thing for us all to be civilized and peaceful enough to say provocative things and to feel confident that violence won't come upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side is, I mean, the terrorists, is this horrible, you know, unbelievable acts of, and the fact that terrorists are willing to kill themselves speaks volumes about how, you know, huge of an issue this is.
Right. Because I think the crook's point for me is always whether or not you can make a solid distinction that Western civilization is far more farther along or more evolved, or, you know, in the Marxian sense, like has grown up more, you know, than like basically Middle Eastern kind of theology, you know, based government. And I think if you can say that, then you can make that justification. Like, you know, freedom of speech is like a higher value, being able to be critical versus, you know, if you truly are a believer of Islam and you're like, listen, like the most important thing is like honoring, you know, God and honoring Muhammad, and you cannot like mess that up.
Yeah.
That's a very different value system.
Yeah.
So if you can say one is more civilized than the other, then you can kind of move forward with that and wage that war, I think, a little bit. And if you can't, if you're saying it's just kind of different value systems, you know, I think you fall in a different camp. And I think the problem there is like how it affects liberals in a, I mean, very privileged way, but like the how it affects liberals in America is that people, liberals are at this weird crook's point where on one side of the part, like you've got the folks who are like critical of religion and are like, this is a problem, you know, and you can't, you really can't, you can't pretend like there's religion isn't feeding into this a little bit, you know, and to not be critical of that is problematic. And I think those are the folks who tend to be like, freedom of speech is the most important thing. Like you need to be able to say whatever you want. Like it's a liberal value. It's a, like a progressive value to be able to do that. And then I think you have like the culturally competent camp, which is about like, hey, like it's important to recognize people have different values based on the culture they're from. So demonizing some people because of their belief system is really, really problematic.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of like the place where I think a lot of people find themselves, at least in educated America.
I think that's well put. I mean, where do you locate yourself between those two poles?
You know, I think that for me, I am a huge believer in freedom of speech. I mean, for God's sakes, we do a podcast. Like, if we didn't have freedom of speech, we couldn't do our podcast, you know? And
or it would just be a podcast all about, like, it would be a podcast all about how great, like, Chairman Mao is. Maybe it would have to be a throwback to it.
Or what if it was, like, or, just, like, bring the the dictatorship to America. It's like we all just had to be like, Obama's so great. Like, isn't he wonderful? Like, he's never smoked a cigarette. Like, you know?
It's not true, though.
I know. But I'm saying it for you. But anyway, so I guess for me, I really value freedom of speech. But as much as I value freedom of speech, I value more, like, the practical interactions between people.
Yeah.
And I think if you, like, some people, like, I would say the people that jump to mind for me are, like, Sam Harris, Bill Maher,
for example, kind of like the intellectual, like atheist group of people.
Yeah, I mean, those are people,
you know,
that
who
I...
are highly critical of Islam and saying basically, like, we need to, like, attack this from an ideological standpoint. I think that that's okay if you're only talking to, like, other very intelligent, sophisticated people, because the fact of the matter is, if that type of thinking, like, trickled down to the masses, all that ends up happening is, like, every woman wearing a burqa gets harassed, you know? And every person who, like, has a different religious belief from you ends up, like, being demonized or put into a camp. So that's why I think, like, when you hear, like, this, there's that statistic Bill Maher talks about all the time that, like, in Egypt, and it's, like, some crazy amount, like, 96% of people believe if you leave Islam, you should be put to death or something like that. And it's, like, that's the type of statistic that, like, if you're, like, a sophisticated thinker, you can be like, oh, like, there's a ton of Muslim people in the world. That represents one country. It also only represents people who voted in that poll. And you can kind of critique it and think about it a little bit more. And then there's, like, people who wouldn't think about that and be like, oh, man, like, 96% of Muslims believe that? You know, and that becomes, like, really problematic. And so, to me, the solution is not to, like, condemn the religion, because all that's going to happen is, like, individuals are going to get hurt from that. Like, collectively, the radical people are not going to be like, you know what? Actually, Bill Maher, you've out-logicked me. And actually, I am wrong. You know what I mean? It has nothing to
doesn't
do
happen.
With that. Right.
Yeah, it's funny you brought that up, because I was just thinking about that statistic recently. And that's the sort of thing that I do struggle with, because I know in America, the, like, Muslim immigrants as a whole are far wealthier and more well-educated than Muslims as a group. So in other words, the Muslims who are privileged enough, basically, to move to America are not the type to be radical, you know, statistically. So we have a really positive relation. Now, I mean, that might seem, after 9/11, there was certainly controversy with a lot of people, I think, harassing Muslims. But compared to France or Germany, I think in general, we have got a pretty good situation here. Whereas I think for European countries, you have people who were born into really horrible situations who have to leave their country of origin out of desperation. Of course, now with Syria, that's especially true. So you have this group of people who potentially don't feel French, don't feel German, maybe didn't want to be there in the first place, and feel ostracized and not a part of their community. The community being France or Germany, and they they develop these little enclaves and become radicalized. I don't know if they were radicalized in the their country of origin or if they become radicalized in that context because they're surrounded by the infidel and they're kept down by the infidel and so on and so forth. It's hard for me to know when I hear stats like something like 90% of Egyptians believe that if you leave the faith, you should be put to death, whether that actually does indicate something pretty real and something that we need to be not afraid of but like very cognizant of, or if it's more like hyperbole and, you know, like it's blown up too much out of proportion. And I don't know the answer to that, really.
Well, and I also think about if I'm like an Egyptian and I'm in a like not the safest political environment and somebody asks me that question, I can tell you I probably know what the safe answer is.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Which is probably yes, you know what I mean? So you know, that's another piece of it, too, is, like, how you answer that survey may have been dictated by fear a little bit.
This is, like, let me ask you about this. So, you hear statistics like the amount of people killed by lightning strikes in a year or in, versus car accidents versus, you know, accidental gunshots and so on. And oftentimes, it makes you pause because certain things kill in far greater numbers than you think, and certain things are maybe not as dangerous as you think and so on. So, 9/11 was a huge event. It was about 3,000 people were killed. But that's pretty atypical. A big event would be maybe 200 people dying. More typical is a dozen in a terrorist attack. And even that is like somewhat sizable. So terrorism, statistically, doesn't kill very many people, especially in America. We're like largely safe. Do you think that alone, the fact that the numbers are small, should be enough to make us sort of back off from all this worry and all this fear and not, say, change our laws and policies? Or is it a really, you know, as horrible as it seems to be?
I think that there's a, when, like, for example, with car accidents, there's, like, a randomness that people accept in car accidents. Like, oh yeah, that car just like went off the road, you know, they got caught in a snowstorm. Now, if you take a social science perspective and you actually do the statistics, there's a good chance you can predict like how many car crashes are going to be. You know, if you keep the speed limit at a certain level, you know how many people are going to die. Like, it's very reliable. But I think the perception of a car accident is that it's very like random, mm-hmm. you know, and there's nothing we can really do to like stop it. Yeah. And part of that is we've all driven a car. We all know what it's like to drive a car. We all know the feeling of almost getting into a car accident, yeah. things like that, or if some of us have been in a car accident, myself included. So, you know, you can relate a little bit more to that. Like, you can be like, oh, I should have been paying attention more. I could have been more defensive, yeah. things like that. Versus, I think when somebody from a different country comes and, like, murders you, you know, that feels like, how did we let this happen?
Yeah.
You know, you don't think about that in terms of a car accident. Like, how did Ford let this happen? How did the government let the speed limit be this?
Yeah.
You know? It doesn't, like, make sense. You don't think of it the same. I think it is the same. Like, we just don't think it through. But I think the perception is different, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that there's a tribalism in it.
Yeah.
You know, which is, like, we in America are like, we're American, you know, we're supposed to be strong, we're supposed to be like free,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when somebody comes and impedes on that, it's not only about the lives being lost, it's about standing up for what we believe is right, I guess, yeah. you know, so.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I was talking to somebody who was really concerned about the refugee crisis coming out of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there have been, I think, 800,000 refugees in total that have left the country.
Wow.
Which is, I can't even, just staggering. I mean, it's just staggering.
It's pretty much like the city of Columbus.
Turkey like, has let in nearly all, many of them.
Yeah.
They've taken the vast majority of them. But European countries obviously are accepting them. There's some, right now, it's, I think it's still open for debate because the Paris attacks were so mm-hmm. recent, but it looks like possibly two people may have come in as yeah. refugees. At first, they thought that was fake. It was just a Syrian passport planted, but it seems now that maybe there were two. So anyways, this person I was talking to made the point that the sheer amount of people
mm-hmm.
being displaced, having to leave their homeland in this horrible situation, that is more human tragedy mm-hmm. than 100 people or so being shot and killed. And that doesn't sound outrageous to me necessarily. I mean, I can understand where he's coming from when he right. says something like that. And at the same time, I totally get why everyone would freak out about the attacks in Paris and would kind of seemingly coldly ignore the refugee crisis in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for the same reasons that you just laid out with driving. The refugee crisis, you can imagine having bad luck and being born into a country where it's just a horrible situation
mm-hmm.
and the sadness of having to leave your country, but choosing to do that willfully because it's a horrible place or you're in a bad circumstance. And you take a chance. You move to another country, you hope things will work out, and you're hot and you're sweaty and you're traveling, you have no money, but you can imagine being that person, making that decision, and it's just sort of like bad luck.
Yeah.
But the thought that someone who grew up in your home city of Paris, who spent most of his or her life there, the fact that they chose to put on a suicide vest, to arm themselves, to walk into a concert venue with a pop rock band
mm-hmm.
and like annihilate people like it's in a video game
mm-hmm.
or like it's an action movie or something in this cold-blooded fashion, it's incomprehensible
yeah.
to people. And so it represents this incredibly scary force. And that, it just makes sense to me on an emotional level why people feel that way.
Yeah.
And then where do we go from there? I don't know.
Well, and I think the thing is they're not even thinking of like a video game. They're literally thinking, I'm going to go to heaven.
Yeah.
And like have sex with tons of virgins.
I wonder, you know, if there's like ecstasy in those moments where terrorists are about to die and when they're killing people and about to detonate the vest, if they feel like the most joy they've ever felt because they yeah. believe so, they have so much faith that they're about to meet God. I can't imagine,
mm-hmm.
but it makes sense that that's where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think you'd be scared shitless, personally.
Like yeah.
That would be, but you obviously go through with it, you know? I think another part of it, though, and I remember hearing this a long time ago, is this idea that there's not really always a choice in the matter. You know, sometimes it's like, okay, you've been chosen, you're going.
Yeah.
And what are you going to say, no?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So sometimes there's like a, if you don't do this, we're going to do things to people that love you. And so, you know, mm-hmm. there's like more to it than just the plain old simple like faith, so...
What do you think about this argument that the whole, like, the economic system, the worldwide economic system
mm-hmm.
is very unfair, and basically what it boils down to is core countries, probably America, chief amongst them,
mm-hmm.
are in a position to exploit developing countries. And a lot of the problems in the world, in the Middle East in particular, that's the result of America and England and France and countries like that. And that some of the terrorism we see is really just justified.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's the kind of the Noam Chomsky argument. You know, that's like, you know, him and Sam Harris kind of go, they wrote that letter kind of thing back and forth to each other, and they kind of went after each other. And I would say Noam Chomsky won that debate.
Just real quick, do you remember when Obama was running for president, he had that pastor in Chicago who became a liability?
Reverend something something.
Yeah, he made a point of saying the chickens have come home to roost. And that's what he was talking about.
Yeah.
Anyways,
what do you mean? Explain
that. Like some of the pain that has been brought America's way was deserved.
Yeah. So here's what I think. I guess on that, I think to be completely ignorant to that is really stupid. You know, I think like if you've read your history, this has occurred forever. You know what I mean? Like foreign countries coming into an area, messing it up, and then the people have to like kind of become radicalized to deal with it. You know, happened with Native Americans here, happened in South America. Like it's happened everywhere, you know, where basically a powerful country has come into a less powerful country. That being said, I also think that there's just some very individualistic things that happen as well, which is, you know, it takes somebody to make a decision to go join ISIS, and they're not sitting there going like, America has, like them putting up a Starbucks has single-handedly made me do this. You know, to me, that's like it's a lack of education, and there's a lot of other things that contribute to that that have nothing to do with, you know, that have nothing to do with like the larger economic system. So to me, I don't go full sociology on that one. I'm kind of like, well, I think there's just a certain level of like maybe like pathology or insanity kind of going on there to begin with. And they're just like attracted to those ideas, you know. You know, I think in the same way, you know, we have that in America, you know, whether you have a county clerk in Kentucky, like who's willing to lose her job for her faith, you know, or you have like the guy, I remember a couple of years ago, he was like letting his cows feed on like public land. And like, he's like a Tea Party hero. And then like, you kind of find out more about the guy. He's like kind of a lunatic, you know, overall, like in multiple avenues of his life. I think it's the same thing. Those same people exist everywhere. They kind of just become like obsessed with the rules, or they become obsessed with something like bigger than themselves, or their life hasn't been fair, so they like navigate to this fantasy world or whatever. You know, and then there's just an element of confirmation bias. Like if you go around looking for things that confirm what you believe, like you're going to see them.
You're going to find them.
You know what I mean? So I think if you go around looking for just examples of American like influence, like destroying everything, you're going to inevitably find it because it's kind of unfalsifiable. You know, you like could take any problem and link it back to American economics, you know? But at the fact, like realistically, could you prove it all?
Yeah, I guess if the thing driving terrorists was overtly political, by the way, terrorism is defined as using terror as a tool for political ends. And I find that kind of interesting because while I think most Islamic radicals meet that definition, I think the argument could be made that they're looking for religious ends as opposed to political ends. I find that kind of an interesting nuance.
Oh, I don't think they would view those as separate as we would.
No, that's a good point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, too, I agree with your analysis in terms of the psychological factors, and it makes me think about that guy from London, Jihadi John, the British press called him. I don't think he was born in Britain. I may be wrong about that, but in any event, he did spend most of his life in London. He's someone who was privileged enough, you might say, to go to college. He had a college education, maybe even a graduate degree, I think, in computer engineering. And so you could say he had the fruits of the core countries. He had a middle-class life, enough money to buy his, you know, stupid iPhone and those sort of things that seemed to pacify people. He was not, say, working in the Congo mining the rare minerals that would be used in an iPhone. He's at that other end of the system. And he chose, for whatever psychological factors, to leave and to go to the Middle East. And he's literally decapitating other human beings. He's literally cutting the heads off other people on a video. And that's the kind of thing where that is like throws a wrench into the machine, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the argument that this is just the chickens coming home to roost. I mean, I don't know how else to get around that. You know what I mean? So if the argument was overtly political, it was capitalism is unjust, America has exploited the world, we have been exploited, we want to change the system, and so on. Even though it would still be murder and I would still be against it, I could sort of understand where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. The fact that it seems so medieval and so primal and right. seems so sort of almost pathological, it's really tough for me to find any point of view where I could see where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. You know? And I want to, because even though they're murderers and the enemy, they're humans.
Right.
And I want to feel like I can empathize with them and understand what motivates them. And I have a lot of trouble understanding that.
But I guess I don't see a big difference between Jihadi John, I guess, and the guys who shoot up Columbine, you know, yeah. or the Sandy Hook people, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. or person or whatever, you know, to me, they're the same people. They're just doing it different ways, you know, which is this murder thing. You know what I mean? It's just murder. Like, that's like, you know, people who are sick and they're paranoid and they have, you know, pathology going on mentally. Mm-hmm. This is what.
But it's more than that, though, because it's not isolated incidences. It's this organization that has a long history, and it's thoroughly connected to religion. Now, if you're a peaceful Muslim, that might horrify you to hear someone say that. I'm sure you'd want to defend your faith, rightfully so. But there's some kind of religious backing to terrorist ideology. Or do you not see it that way?
I guess I'm... You know, I don't know, Keith, to be honest. I have mixed feelings on that one, I would say. Is it more likely to happen in Middle Eastern countries with Middle Eastern faiths? Like, yeah. I mean, you'd be an idiot to argue against that. Like, there's just zero evidence the other way, you know? That's definitely going to occur. But I think for me, it's like, is that any different than gang members, like, shooting each other?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it any different than a person going into a theater during Batman and shooting up everybody? Is it any different than a pedophile, like, raping some? You know what I mean? I feel like these people exist. They, like, hurt people. And I think it just, they happen to gravitate toward one thing in that region, you know, because that's the thing, you know, I mean, it's like, that's where, if you're violent, that's where you go. So maybe the violence is just more diverse here in terms of where those people end up,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Cause I mean, there's rapists, there's killers, there's everybody in America, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I do know there's the boundary between Syria and Iraq is called the Sykes-Picot line.
Okay.
And that was a French guy and a British guy after World War I, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
They drew that boundary. So it was basically Europeans taking a map and drawing a line and determining the boundary of these countries.
Mm.
That's roughly where ISIS is now. And they've made a point of erasing that line.
Wow.
They say that's not a natural division.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right. And then they've erased it. So when I hear about something like that, that sounds like Western imperialism imprinting artificial boundaries in a place that doesn't belong to them, and then that getting undone and rejected.
But is that really imperialism, or is that like the result of losing a war? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like if the Middle Eastern folks hadn't, I believe some of them fought on behalf of the Nazis, right?
No, I don't know.
I think that's what happened. Like some Middle Eastern countries.
Well, no, we're talking. This would have been World War I, so that can't be the case.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
We shouldn't. There's some truth to what I'm thinking. I know because I know there's like the famous story about like Churchill, like kind of helping decide the boundaries of the Middle East a little bit.
Yeah.
So I wish I was more educated on that, but.
Or even Israel. I don't have a strong opinion for or against. To be perfectly frank, I think now that Israel exists, I think it's something that should. Mm-hmm. continue to exist and exist peacefully and should be respected. But I can appreciate if you live in the Middle East and you see this artificial country formed through force because of European powers, that would feel like, I think, I don't know, an interjection in their affairs.
But see, it's not so much an interjection in their affairs as much as it is like you solemnly believing that their religion makes them the enemy. You know what I mean? So, like the reason they're against Israel is because they're Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's, like, a Jewish area.
Yeah.
And they fundamentally believe that, like, the Jews are, like against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And, I mean, they are as a result of, like, tons and tons of wars
yeah.
and the never-ending bombings that have occurred between, yeah. like, Palestine, Israel, and other areas.
Terrorism almost resolutely affects people who are not living in core Western countries.
Right.
So like something like literally like 98%, maybe a little bit less, but mm-hmm. somewhere around there, the victims of terrorists are Middle Easterners and mm-hmm. Africans. I've got a list here. The heading I'm looking at now is 80% of 2013's terrorism deaths took place in five countries. Hmm. 35% of these deaths were in Iraq. 17% were in Afghanistan. 13% in Pakistan. 10% Nigeria. 6% Syria. So between those countries, that constitutes 80%. Mm-hmm. So it's also probably incredibly aggravating from the point of view of the rest of the world, or particularly if you live in the Middle East, to hear Westerners sort of whining about terrorism when you're the victim of it,
like
through and through. Nobody cares about your terrorism. And a lot of your terrorism, especially in Iraq, is the result one way or another of American decisions. It's, mm-hmm. I can imagine just how ridiculous and intolerable and aggravating that would seem.
See, but again, I don't necessarily buy that idea that it's America's fault that one Iraqi person decides to bomb another Iraqi person.
That's rough for me to, because I kind of do in a sense. Yeah. That's a bit more challenging because we invaded their country and for a reason that turned out to be bogus. And so like it's sort of like stirring up the hornet's nest or mm-hmm. something like that. You can't pinpoint, like everyone has their own destiny, and you can't say that individual at that point was influenced by America magically. You can never do that. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you in that sense. But like from the zoomed out point of view, we messed up their country and then things have fallen apart and you get all this craziness, all this death and terrorism as a result. Right. One way or another, it seems like you have to point the finger at us to some extent.
But I guess the problem in the logic there for me is that you're kind of, not you, but collectively, the argument is that you're zooming out, but then you're just stopping at a certain point that's convenient.
Yeah.
Why not zoom out all the way to the idea of religion is like dying? Hmm. You know, like across the huge entire human race, and this is kind of the last flicker before it completely, like old style religion, kind of dies. Why not zoom out even farther and go like from the 100,000 foot view, mm-hmm. like this type of society is kind of dying off, and like the Middle East, and only those are the most extreme are still like living in the desert there, you know, and most other people have moved to more like moderate climates and things like that. You know what I mean? So I just feel like when you stop at America, you know, as opposed to like white people mm-hmm. or Western culture or whatever, you're just deciding to stop there with your zoom out lens.
Yeah.
And I feel like you could zoom out even farther. You could zoom in. And to me, it's kind of artificial. So the only ways I think that makes sense to really, really look at it is to really zoom in and go, what was going on for that one person? And then after a while, you collect enough information and you kind of feel like, okay, every person is saying it's because of America.
Yeah.
Every single one. You know what I mean? Yeah. Then I think we have like information. If they're saying like that person, I hated that person, I hated that part of the government, that's something different, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it comes down to how much responsibility does someone in one country have for those in another. Like their fellow human beings, if they're living under Saddam Hussein mm-hmm. and he's clearly this horrible guy, how do we, not worse than a horrible guy, everybody says he was a horrible guy, he really was mm-hmm. despotic to the, you know, upteenth degree, would have been mm-hmm. kind of a living hell,
right.
And not kind of a 1984 sort of deal living in his Iraq.
Right.
So if that's the case, do you merely refuse to like buy oil from him? I guess that seems reasonable enough. Or do mm-hmm. you say it's not our responsibility at all and you pay him for lots of oil, give him money, knowing that that money ultimately will be used to help keep people down? Is it your responsibility to liberate those people? Like, what do you do? And if you
where I think it goes back to that, like that first question I rose, which is if you fundamentally believe that Western culture is farther along, which I think the U.S. government essentially endorses that belief, is saying that if we aren't the moral authority, these people are just going to kill each other. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So we have to go in and make decisions and like set up a democracy and, you know, do all this stuff to kind of force the culture along, you know, to catch up with the rest of the world. And I think you there's plenty of examples of that where I think most people wouldn't realize that they're agreeing with that idea. So that sounds
like I mean, on the surface, that sounds like such a disgusting thing.
Yeah, it sounds like such a but then you think about like female genital mutilation.
Yeah.
Right? Like we are clearly saying in America, like women being able to keep their clitoris and like keep their vagina intact. Not women,
girls.
Yeah, women and girls, like being able to keep those things intact is better than not keeping it intact, you know? So we draw the line there because it's like, that's terrible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, how come we, what other things do we not? So it's like the way a woman having to cover herself from like head to toe, like we're like, oh no, that's just different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like a different form of oppression, but we've said this one's okay because there's like not physical damage.
That's interesting because it's interesting you brought up that second case because I know in France they made that illegal. They outlawed the is it the burqa, the full from head to toe? And then girls in public schools weren't allowed to even wear the veil. And that was a horrible disaster. I guess there were a lot of girls who shaved their heads so that boys couldn't see their hair in that way because they were forced to take the veil off.
Wow.
That seems to me a case where there should be much greater cultural sensitivity.
Right.
But that's France trying to sort of force everyone to be equal. In a good spirit. I mean, like, the French Revolution did result in the rights of man. I mean, a very important statement on human rights. And equality, fraternity, and so on. These are positive values that we need to stand up for. But I think they can be applied in ways that are really destructive.
So I think that the person endorsing the view I said earlier, which I'm not endorsing, I'm just saying that this is the view, would be like, oh, the fact that some girls like would just let their hair be shown, and then within a generation that like tradition would be forgot, is pushing that culture forward, you know, and moving it into like the 21st century. Versus like what you said is maybe more the traditional or like contemporary liberal belief of like, no, it's just like a different value system, you know, because in one, you're kind of going, history has dictated this, you know, like people are making these choices not because they're their choices. They're making these choices because historically they've been oppressed and that oppression has been internalized. And now that internalized oppression is like is feeling like a free will choice to them.
Yeah.
In the other view, you actually are accepting that they have free will, that they actually did go, hey, like, no, I want to do this. This is something I believe I want, you know, and I think that that's a. It's like an academic argument, you know, it's like, is there truly free will or, you know, and I don't mean like in the philosophical way. I mean, is there truly free will in terms of cultural choices? Because Jihadi Johnny clearly made a choice. You know, he was like, there was no reason he should do that, right? He should stay in England and get a job at a Verizon or, you know, and like do his thing, you know. And he didn't, you know, so that would be a case where, like, clearly you can break it. You know, all you need is one example of somebody breaking culture to show it doesn't have complete control over somebody, you know?
Yeah, it's really tough because it comes down to drawing a line that's sort of impossible to draw between core countries that are highly developed, exploiting poorer countries, and then also countries that are very developed being very developed. And being very forward and having ideas having been percolated that haven't been percolated in other countries. Or maybe even Christianity having gone through a reformation that Islam doesn't really have an analog to.
Right.
You know, there's a certain kind of development. Ideas like, you know, Darwin's evolution. Or there's certain, like, important ideas that our culture has had to sort of digest and deal with. Separation of church and state. I mean, these are Enlightenment ideas that America, in particular in France, were founded on. And, when, you know, Europe in general. And these are things that I really value. These things, these are things that I treasure. And I tend to think they are universal, or at least somewhat universal.
Yeah.
But that is sort of a scary proposition, that I am claiming I'm special, I'm privileged, I have access to information. I was lucky, I was born into one of those countries that's highly developed, and now I'm going to imprint this uniformly across the world.
But see, I think, you know what, I'm going to say it's not that you're special and enlightened. I'm going to add a different twist on that. I'm going to borrow it from Richard Dawkins, which is so rare because I'm not a big Richard Dawkins fan. So this is a big, big moment for Kip. But it's not that. It's that it produces results. You know, so he always says, like, why do we believe in science over religion? He's like, because you can make an airplane fly with science. You know, religion, you can't do that, right? So it's the same thing here. Like, being critical of the government produces better government. You know, like, because they have to be responsive to the people. Democracy in itself produces like a better system of government, so we like to endorse that. You know, when you can't do those things, we know what happens. It's like when you can't be critical of a government, like it results in a totalitarian thank you, Keith, totalitarian, you know, system. You know,
so maybe two kind of things to consider before we wind the podcast down. One is considering, for instance, Donald Trump, his popularity and how anti-immigrant he's been. And just, can I just say, just nasty. And just like an ethos of xenophobia, hatred, kind of a cocky masculinity. If he were to, say, become president, and there was another 9/11 type of incident, and everyone was incredibly afraid, I do fear that he could use that fear, that collective fear, to steer the country in a really bad place, in a kind of, you know, proto-fascism sort of thing. Well, what are your thoughts on that before?
I guess my thought first is that I don't think there's a possibility of him becoming president, but, but, you know, I've been wrong before.
Are you a Ben Carson man?
Not a man. Yeah, I'm a Rubio guy, I guess. I guess of any of them, I guess I like Rand Paul, but only because he's, like, basically, his social beliefs are pretty much liberal, you know? Yeah. So I like him for that reason, I guess. But, you know, I don't really see that happening, I guess. I think there's too much, like, right now he's just pandering to, like, the rightest right wing. You know what I mean? And that's going to work. But the fact of the matter is, like, I just heard this stat the other day. Only 14% of the country are registered Republicans. And they're the only ones who are voting in any of this stuff. So, like...
Wait, say that again?
Only 14% of the country are registered Republicans.
That's interesting.
And so, whenever you're looking at these demographics and everything, you're only looking at, like...
That's amazing.
A tiny percent of the population. But the fact of the matter is, they vote. You know, the 14% vote consistently.
Do you know what percent is registered Democrats?
I don't off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just a very small... I would bet smaller. That would be my guess.
Probably true.
So as a result, like when you're talking about Donald Trump supporters, if he has, you know, 35% of the vote or whatever, we're talking like 1 to 2 or 3%, you know, what people are really passionate about him, you know, versus like you have to win over the at least moderate liberals who I think are still going to view him as a joke.
Yeah.
You know?
The second issue that I wanted to hear your opinion on was how do you think this is going to play out? In general terms, over the next decade, let's say. I mean, do you think this is going to blow over, or do you think something's going to happen?
Truthfully, I think it's going to play out exactly how it always plays out, which is, and we saw it, immediately when France got, you know, this happened to them, there was flag waving, there was patriotism, only like the French version of patriotism. You know, everybody's waving flags, and then what happened within 24 hours, 20 bombs got dropped. And probably killed a shitload of civilians, you know, and I think that's what's going to happen is it's going to keep reproducing itself because the fact of the matter is you can't battle this stuff with bombs. You have to battle it with ideology and education, and you have to eventually, like, in tariffs and cutting people off and going, like, until you treat women right, you don't get trade with us, you know. And you just can't, you can't bomb radical people into thinking, you know, it's kind of like the whole ISIS like system is based on, like, when those bombs got dropped, they probably got even more recruits.
Yeah, you exactly. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that's true. I think it's really, we have to frame the issue in those sort of terms that you just laid out. It can't be that finally it's like the line has been crossed and now it's going to be full-scale war. I think that's exactly what a group like ISIS wants. I think we have to have enough restraint in the middle of these horrible events to continue to treat terrorism mostly as almost an issue that the police would fight. Now, I don't mean police actually, I just mean intelligence. So about wiretapping people who are, you know, particularly suspicious and so on, and following those kinds of leads, with education in the schools or whatever kind of maybe we need sort of new cutting edge novel programs to reach sort of troubled youth, or, you know, quote unquote troubled youth, or people who are like more likely than others to become radicalized. Maybe that's nonsense, but it seems to me a good idea. The only thing that does give me pause is because of Russia now in particular wanting to destroy ISIS, because the plane went down in Egypt, and it was probably ISIS that took the plane down. This is a recent event too. I can imagine a scenario where big European powers, France, Germany, Russia, maybe America, basically all decide it's in their interest to wage a full-scale war against ISIS, to put boots on the ground, and as like a giant coalition to implant themselves in the Middle East and fight a more traditional war. And that seems, based on what I've experienced in my life and what I know about the Middle East, bound to end badly.
Right.
The other option doesn't seem great either, which is basically tolerating ISIS as a group in the middle of the Middle East. And I don't know where that leads to.
Well, here's the thing, though, that bothers me about it is this... It's kind of like a small group of people make a decision, and then we wage a war on a country or wage a war on an entire area.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is, like, insane, and it's based on American precedent, mm-hmm. you know? It's like a small group of terrorists, you know, basically attack the World Trade Center, and we have two or three wars as a result on countries, mm-hmm. you know, Afghanistan, Iran, it's crazy. Iraq, it's crazy. Much, you know, to some extent, and even like going into Pakistan and everything. So to me, it's like when we basically like equate that, that's really problematic, you know, versus instead going like, okay, like what happened here? Let's investigate it. How can we prevent it from happening again in the future? You know, what steps can we put into place to make ourselves more safe? There's this idea that we're going to just go and bomb the shit out of them, and then they're not going to mess with us anymore, which is just the opposite of how it works. Like, it's just the pure and simple. Like, you are not going to... Because what... There was this great phrase I heard the other day. Like, ISIS has the ability to melt into the society. You know what I mean? That's all they have to do. They're like, okay, we're all together. Now we're going to leave. We're all going to go back to the society. And then we'll meet up again later. And that's what can happen. And it's an endlessly reproducing cycle of people.
Yeah.
So you can't do it. Like, I just don't get the philosophy of, like, that, you know, I know people make fun of this all the time. But it's that, like, America, fuck yeah kind of attitude. But it's any country that gets, like, bombed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, like we got to retaliate.
Yeah.
Rather than like as a mature society stepping back and going, okay, what happened here? Okay, these people got into our country and did this. Like, how can we stop this kind of thing from happening again?
Yeah. Yeah.
The solution's never going to be drop more bombs on more people. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, that's never going to make it work.
Yeah, I'd say tribalism is the enemy. If you see tribalism in foreigners, mm-hmm. that's the enemy. If you see tribalism in yourself, that's the enemy too.
Right.
The goal is to be a civilized human being
mm-hmm.
and expect to be treated civilized and only sort of respond when provoked and in a reasonable manner.
Yeah. So.
It's tough stuff.
It's, yeah. So, yeah, I think that's pretty much it for
I think it was a good conversation.
Yeah, it was a little... Yeah, it felt like a very serious tone. The seriousness of the thing definitely carried over. We barely made any jokes at all.
It's tough to make jokes about terrorism.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Anyway, all right, everybody. Thanks a lot. I'm Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
This is Keith McIntosh.
Arrivederci.
Arrivederci.
Hey, guys, if you enjoyed the show, check out Kip and Keith on Facebook at Midwestern Social Scientists. You can also tweet them at hashtag Midwestern Social Scientists. Or you can check out their Podomatic page, which is the first place the episodes get released. Don't miss out. Yeah, just check out their Facebook, okay? Thanks.